Content note, this episode of So Many Books, So Little Time contains rather violent depictions of sexual assault, dehumanization and objectification of women, violence and death, and hospital scenes and psychiatry scenes, and some pretty nasty medical malpractice. So please be safe. And obviously war. Well, yes.
Hey, folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Please join us as we continue with Catch 22 by Joseph Heller with Chapter 26, Rue's favorite character, Arfie.
Yeah.
I was not being sarcastic at all. Rue loves Arfie.
Yuck.
Rue wants to hit me now.
Yes. No, it's okay. Good thing we're remote recording. No. I am not that violent. Ooh, you know what? Just throwing this idea to the world out there at large. Nothing to do with Arfie. Nothing to do with every day. My mom had this whole discussion about... Okay, backstory. I was washing my face and I have a little headband and it has cat ears on it. And my mom was joking and saying, oh, you've got an extra set of ears. Maybe you can hear me better, et cetera, et cetera. And then she went, you know, actually, they should, like, what? I wonder if you could design, like, a headset for kids, maybe, particularly, that kind of works like a hearing aid, but using, like, cat ears, like a structure, like cat ears that work like a hearing aid so they can conduct through the headband. Okay. Into so the mic's kind of up there in the ears, and it goes into through some sort of system into the for hard of hearing or those who need hearing aids, so that when they're younger they can have a little bit of fun, and it's a larger thing so it doesn't get lost as easily, etc., etc. And I kind of had a moment like, that would actually kind of be cool. Like little animatronic ears.
Could light up, could fold over.
Yeah, you could have lots of fun. I mean, we've got headphones like that, but why not actually have them as a device that assists people with, you know, hearing barriers? Mm. A hearing tool. Why not? Okay. So throwing that out there into the random universe, and yes, totally unrelated to anything to do with Arfie.
I'm just trying to get out of reading this chapter.
No, we will read this chapter. It will happen.
We'll get it out of the way.
Yes. And
who knows, like many other characters, we might find some sympathy for Arfie due to his circumstances that made him what he is.
Seriously doubt it.
True, because I think I said this, I now feel sorry for Cathcart, but I don't like him.
Nope. And Arfie, there is nothing about Arfie that is redeemable yet. And I don't think there will be. Because he just comes across as someone who's deliberately contentious, likes to get a rise out of people, everything is about his entertainment, and he looks down on absolutely everyone.
Yeah, you know, say what you want about Havermeyer, but at least he does his job.
Well, Havermeyer has one purpose and one purpose only.
Hmm.
Yes, yes.
True. You know, it's that weird thing where even with awful people, it's always better if you know where you stand.
Yes, whereas Arf is just obstructive and a pain in the butt. But yes.
So, let's talk a little about what happened last time, because that has been a while since we recorded. Let's see, what did happen last time? Was the chaplain, was it?
Yeah, the chaplain. We got to see how... The due to a cruel twist in circumstances, Major and the chaplain kind of kept missing each other. The chaplain keeps thinking everyone's... So the chaplain's lack of assertiveness is an issue. The chaplain is now being basically... what's his name? The guy who's assigned to him.
Whitcomb.
Whitcomb. Yes, Whitcomb has...
Or Combe.
Yeah, Whitcomb and Colonel Cathcart have just basically generated a giant mess for him as well, on top of everything else with the letters.
Yeah, and when it doesn't work, he'll probably get the blame for it.
Yep, even though he did not sign off on it.
Yep.
So Whitcomb is going ahead and doing whatever. And I bet you Whitcomb's going to sign off as, what's his name?
Washington Irving.
Yes, I think that Whitcomb's going to sign off as Washington Irving. I bet you.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I have to wonder if that's going to be like a tenuous through line to the end of the book.
I wonder if it is. It would make sense. I wonder if Washington Irving, I mean, we know, we looked into it and he was, I think, a writer a long, long time ago.
Mm.
So yeah, that would make sense. It would, like, I mean, I can't remember. I thought we looked up what he'd written.
It was, if he was a writer, I remember... Yeah, sorry, folks. My memory and my cognition isn't the best today just because I'm feeling a little under the weather. Yeah. But we're going to soldier through this episode as best we can, both Rue and I. I remember it came up alongside other authors' names that Heller had used for this book.
Okay, so he wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle and an extensive biography of George Washington.
Mm.
That would be interesting that was the choice, like if that's a deliberate choice by the author. I mean, I suspect there is actually a reason behind it.
Mm.
And I wonder if the reason is that he's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow is a horror concept. He does a lot of biographies. He was the American ambassador to Spain.
Wasn't Rip Van Winkle like the guy who slept for hundreds of years?
I think Rip Van Winkle also was falls asleep 20 years. He missed the American Revolution. It's the idea of nostalgia.
Yeah.
So I'm just double checking. So he's nostalgia. He's the nostalgia towards the past and how that throws you off, I guess. And George Washington's, George Washington's biography is interesting. I'm wondering whether he's done anything else. Literary reputation. He was the first American man of letters. Ha, 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 ha. That's what it is. The first American man of letters. To earn his living solely by his pen.
It's a very archaic saying, but I still love the idea of referring to an author as a man of letters.
Yes. So he was the one who started basically the concept of American literature.
Mm.
He perfected the American short story. And even when he poached from other folklore, it was strictly related to America.
Well, yeah, because the Legend of Sleepy Hollow has kind of become legend. It's one of those myths from the U.S.
Edgar Allan Poe felt he should be given credit for being an innovator, but the writing itself was rather unsophisticated and overrated. So he said there's his surreptitious... Some of it he's done is done well, some not so much.
Well, we don't need to continue. We got the man of letters. No. That's obviously the basis for the whole pun.
I think that's the pun. Oh, you know the expression Gotham for New York? Irving popularized the nickname Gotham.
Okay.
For New York. And also the almighty dollar.
Hmm.
Which, again, this actually all ties in really well with this book.
Mm-hmm.
Holy. Sneaky, sneaky Heller. I would love to read an essay just explaining why Heller would have chosen Washington Irving. That would be fascinating. I would be really interested in knowing why
Washington Irving... Not just that, but I imagine there is many literary references, or just references in Catch-22, because it's so humorous that basically you can see the author having fun as we've been reading it.
I think so. There's,
you know, the whole, even in that first chapter where Yossarian was signing Washington Irving's name just solely to amuse himself. And mm-hmm. I have a feeling that Heller's been doing the same as he was writing this book.
Mm-hmm. They seem, yeah. communication and miscommunication. Which, yes, that makes sense. Because how many times have we had a scene where there's been miscommunication or misunderstanding just based on the language that's used or how something has been said?
Oh, it's practically a theme at this point.
Exactly, exactly. So, like, that makes sense. Because if you're thinking Washington Irving, if you're thinking letters, if you think communication, one of the first notable, well, the first person to really make a living using language and communication in, from the U.S.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty intense. But yes. Yeah.
Well, I think we put it off long enough, Rue.
Let's get on with Arfi.
It's time to talk about or read about Arfi. Arfi, Arfi, Arfi.
Yes.
Chapter 26, Arfi. In a way, it was all Yessarian's fault, for if he had not moved the bomb line during the big siege of Bologna, Major de Coverley might still be around to save him, and if he had not stocked the enlisted men's apartment with girls who had no other place to live, Nately might never have fallen in love with his as she sat naked from waist down in the room full of grumpy blackjack players who ignored her. Nately stared at her covertly from his overstuffed yellow armchair, marveling at the bored, phlegmatic strength with which she accepted the mass rejection. She yawned, and he was deeply moved. He had never witnessed such heroic poise before. The girl had climbed 5 steep flights of stairs to sell herself to the group of satiated enlisted men who had girls living there all around them. None wanted her at any price, not even after she had stripped without real enthusiasm to tempt them with a tall body that was firm and full and truly voluptuous. She seemed more fatigued than disappointed. Now she sat resting in vacuous indolence, watching the card game with dull curiosity as she gathered her recalcitrant energies for the tedious chore of donning the rest of her clothing and going back to work. In a little while she stirred. A little while later she rose with an unconscious sigh and stepped lethargically into her tight cotton panties and dark skirt, then buckled on her shoes and left. Nately slipped out behind her, and when Yessarian and Arfi entered the officer's apartment almost 2 hours later, there she was again, stepping into her panties and skirt, and it was almost like the chaplain's recurring sensation of having been through a situation before, except for Nately, who was moping inconsolably with his hands in his pockets. "She wants to go now," he said in a faint, strange voice. "She doesn't want to stay." "Why don't you just pay her some money to let you spend the rest of the day with her?" Yessarian advised. "She gave me my money back," Nately admitted. "She's tired of me now and wants to go looking for someone else." The girl paused when her shoes were on to glance in surly invitation at Yessarian and Arfi. Her breasts were pointy and large in the thin white sleeveless sweater she wore that squeezed each contour and flowed outward smoothly with the tops of her enticing hips. Yessarian returned her gaze and was strongly attracted. He shook his head. "Good riddance to bad rubbish," was Arfi's unperturbed response. "Don't say that about her," Nately protested with passion that was both a plea and a rebuke. "I want her to stay with me." "What's so special about her?" Arfi sneered with mock surprise. "She's only a b-, and don't call her a b-." The girl shrugged impassively after a few more seconds and ambled toward the door. Nately bounded forward wretchedly to hold it open. He wandered back in a heartbroken daze, his sensitive face eloquent with grief. "Don't worry about it," Yessarian consoled him as kindly as he could. "You'll probably be able to find her again. We know where all the b**ps hang out." "Please don't call her that," Nately begged, looking as though he might cry. "I'm sorry," murmured Yessarian. Arfi thundered jovially. "There are hundreds of b**ps just as good crawling all over the streets. That one wasn't even pretty." He chuckled mellifluously with resonant disdain and authority. "Why, you rushed forward to open that door as though you were in love with her." "I think I am in love with her," Nately confessed in a shamed, far-off voice. Arfi wrinkled his chubby, round, rosy forehead in comic disbelief. "Ho, ho, ho, ho," he laughed, patting the expansive, forest-green sides of his officer's tunic prosperously. "That's rich. You in love with her. That's really rich." Arfi had a date that same afternoon with a Red Cross girl from Smith, whose father owned an important milk of magnesia plant. Now that's the kind of girl you ought to be associating with, and not with common Ugh. And not with common b****s like that one. Why, she didn't even look clean. I don't care, Nately shouted desperately. And I wish you'd shut up. I don't even want to talk about it with you. Arfi, shut up, said Ysarion. Ho, 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 Arfi continued. I just can't imagine what your father and mother would say if they knew you were running around with filthy trollops like that one. Your father is a very distinguished man, you know. I'm not going to tell him, Nately declared with determination. I'm not going to say a word about her to him or mother until after we're married. Married? Arfi's indulgent merriment swelled tremendously. Ho, 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 ho! Now you're really talking stupid. Why, you're not even old enough to know what true love is. Arfi was an authority on the subject of true love because he had already fallen truly in love with Nately's father, and with the prospect of working for him after the war in some executive capacity as a reward for befriending Nately. Arfi was a lead navigator who had never been able to find himself since leaving college. He was a genial, magnanimous lead navigator who could always forgive the other man in the squadron for denouncing him furiously each time he got lost on a combat mission and led them over concentrations of anti-aircraft fire. He got lost on the streets of Rome that same afternoon and never did find the eligible Red Cross girl from Smith with the important milk of magnesia plant. He got lost on the mission to Ferrara the day Kraft was shot down and killed, and he got lost again on the weekly milk run to Parma and tried to lead the planes out to sea over the city of Leghorn after Ysarion had dropped his bombs on the undefended inland target and settled back against his thick wall of armor plate with his eyes closed and a fragrant cigarette in his fingertips. Suddenly there was flak, and all at once McWatt was shrieking over the intercom, "Flak! Flak! Where the hell are we? What the hell is going on?" Ysarion flipped his eyes open in alarm and saw the totally unexpected bulging black puffs of flak crashing down in toward them from high up and Arfi's complacent, melon-round, tiny-eyed face gazing out at the approaching cannon bursts with affable bemusement. I just want to say here, with some of the adjectives Heller's using to describe Arfi, it sounds like he's a bit of a chunky fellow.
Yeah, but it's moral association with appearance.
Right. You're thinking he made him rotund to kind of say, yeah, look at this guy.
Yeah.
Of course he's like this.
Yes. It's a thing. It's industrial fat cats. It's, you know, like that kind of...
Yeah, even when he was making fun of Nately, it kind of felt like he was rolling his fingers on his belly. Ho, 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 ho. Well, he used the word ho, ho, ho. Like, that's Santa.
Yeah, there's a kind of a evil, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Ysarion was flabbergasted. His leg went abruptly to sleep. McWatt had started to climb and was yelping over the intercom for instructions. Ysarion sprang forward to see where they were and remained in the same place. He was unable to move. Then he realized he was sopping wet. He looked down at his crotch with a sinking sick sensation. A wild crimson blot was crawling upward rapidly along his shirt front like an enormous sea monster rising to devour him. He was hit. Separate trickles of blood spilled to a puddle on the floor through one saturated trouser leg, like countless unstoppable swarms of wriggling red worms. His heart stopped. A second solid jolt struck the plane. Ysarion shuddered with revulsion at the queer sight of his wound and screamed at Arfi for help. I lost my balls! Arfi, I lost my balls! Arfi didn't hear, and Ysarion bent forward and tugged at his arm. Arfi, help me! He pleaded, almost weeping. I'm hit! I'm hit! Arfi turned slowly with a bland, quizzical grin. What? I'm hit, Arfi, help me! Arfi grinned again and shrugged amiably. I can't hear you, he said. Can't you see me? Ysarion cried incredulously, and he pointed to the deepening pool of blood he felt splashing down all around him and spreading out underneath. I'm wounded! Help me, for God's sake! Arfi, help me! I still can't hear you, Arfi complained tolerantly, cupping his podgy hand behind the blanched corolla of his ear. What did you say? Ysarion answered in a collapsing voice, weary suddenly of shouting so much, of the whole frustrating, exasperating, ridiculous situation. He was dying, and no one took notice. Never mind. What? Arfi shouted. I said I lost my balls. Can't you hear me? I'm wounded in the groin. I still can't hear you, Arfi chided. I said never mind, Ysarion screamed with a trapped feeling of terror and began to shiver, feeling very cold suddenly and very weak. Arfi shook his head regretfully again and lowered his obscene, lactescent ear almost directly into Ysarion's face. You'll just have to speak up, my friend. You'll just have to speak up. Leave me alone, you bastard. You dumb, insensitive bastard. Leave me alone, Ysarion sobbed. He wanted to pummel Arfi, but lacked the strength to lift his arms. He decided to sleep instead and keeled over sideways into a dead faint. He was wounded in the thigh, and when he recovered consciousness, he found McWatt on both knees taking care of him. He was relieved, even though he still saw Arfi's bloated cherub's face hanging down over McWatt's shoulder with placid interest. Ysarion smiled feebly at McWatt, feeling ill, and asked, "Who's minding the store?" McWatt gave no sign that he heard. With growing horror, Ysarion gathered in breath and repeated the words as loudly as he could. McWatt looked up. "Christ, I'm glad you're still alive," he exclaimed, heaving an enormous sigh. The good-humored, friendly crinkles about his eyes were white with tension and oily with grime as he kept unrolling an interminable bandage around the bulky cotton compress Ysarion felt strapped burdensomely to the inside of one thigh. "Natalie's at the controls. The poor kid almost started bawling when he heard you were hit. He still thinks you're dead. They knocked open an artery for you, but I think I've got it stopped. I gave you some morphine. Give me some more. It might be too soon. I'll give you some more when it starts to hurt. It hurts now." "Oh, well, what the hell," said McWatt, and injected another syringe of morphine into Ysarian's arm. "When you tell Natalie I'm all right," said Ysarion to McWatt, and lost consciousness again as everything went fuzzy behind a film of strawberry strain gelatin, and a great baritone buzz swallowed him in sound. He came to in the ambulance and smiled encouragement at Dr. Nika's weevil-like, glum, and overshadowed countenance for the dizzy second or two he had before everything went rose petal pink again and then turned really black and unfathomably still. Ysarion woke up in the hospital and went to sleep. When he woke up in the hospital again, the smell of ether was gone, and Dunbar was lying in pajamas in the bed across the aisle, maintaining that he was not Dunbar but a fortiori. Ysarion thought he was cracked. He curled his lips skeptically at Dunbar's bit of news and slept on it fitfully for a day or two, then woke up while the nurses were elsewhere and eased himself out of bed to see for himself. The floor swayed like the floating raft at the beach, and the stitches on the inside of his thigh bit into his flesh like fine sets of fish teeth as he limped across the aisle to peruse the name on the temperature card on the foot of Dunbar's bed. But sure enough, Dunbar was right. He was not Dunbar anymore, but Second Lieutenant Anthony F. Fortiori. What the hell's going on? A. Fortiori got out of bed and motioned to Ysarion to follow. Grasping for support at anything he could reach, Ysarion limped along after him into the corridor and down the adjacent ward to a bed containing a harried young man with pimples and a receding chin. The harried young man rose on one elbow with alacrity as they approached. A Fortiori jerked his thumb over his shoulder and said, "Screw." The harried young man jumped out of bed and ran away. A Fortiori climbed into the bed and became Dunbar again. "That was A Fortiori," Dunbar explained. "They didn't have an empty bed in your ward, so I pulled my rank and chased them back here into mine. It's a pretty satisfying experience pulling rank. You ought to try it sometime. You ought to try it right now, in fact, because you look like you're going to fall down." Ysarion felt like he was going to fall down. He turned to the lantern-jawed, leather-faced, middle-aged man lying in the bed next to Dunbar's, jerked his thumb over his shoulder, and said, "Screw." The middle-aged man stiffened fiercely and glared. "He's a major," Dunbar explained. "Why don't you aim a little lower and try becoming Warrant Officer Homer Lumley for a while? Then you can have a father in the state legislature and a sister who's engaged to a champion skier. Just tell him you're a captain." Ysarion turned to the startled patient Dunbar had indicated. "I'm a captain," he said, jerking his thumb over his shoulder. "Screw." The startled patient jumped down to the floor at Ysarian's command and ran away. Birdies.
It's also interesting because this is from a health management perspective, terrifying.
The startled patient jumped down to the floor at Ysarian's command and ran away. Ysarion climbed up into his bed and became Warrant Officer Homer Lumley, who felt like vomiting and was covered suddenly with a clammy sweat. He slept for an hour and wanted to be Ysarion again. It did not mean so much to have a father in the state legislature and a sister who was engaged to a champion skier. Dunbar led the way back to Ysserion's ward, where he thumbed a fortiori out of bed to become Dunbar again for a while. There was no sign of Warrant Officer Homer Lumley. Nurse Kramer was there, though, and sizzled with sanctimonious anger like a damp firecracker. She ordered Ysserion to get right back into bed and blocked his path so he couldn't comply. Her pretty face was more repulsive than ever. Nurse Kramer was a good-hearted, sentimental creature who rejoiced unselfishly at news of weddings, engagements, births, and anniversaries, even though she was unacquainted with any of the people involved. "Are you crazy?" she scolded virtuously, shaking an indignant finger in front of his eyes. "I suppose you just don't care if you kill yourself, do you?" "It's myself," he reminded her. "I suppose you just don't care if you lose your leg, do you?" "It's my leg." "It certainly is not your leg," Nurse Kramer retorted. "That leg belongs to the U.S. government. It's no different than a gear or a bedpan."
"Wow."
"The army has invested a lot of money to make you an airline pilot, and you've no right to disobey the doctor's orders." Ysserion was not sure he liked being invested in. Nurse Kramer was still standing directly in front of him so that he could not pass. His head was aching. Nurse Kramer shouted at him some question he could not understand. He jerked his thumb over his shoulder and said, "Screw!" Nurse Kramer cracked him in the face so hard she almost knocked him down. Ysserion drew back his fist to punch her in the jaw just as his leg buckled and he began to fall. Nurse Duckett strode up in time to catch him. She addressed them both firmly. "Just what's going on here?" "He won't get back into his bed," Nurse Kramer reported zealously.
"Because you're in the way!" Yeah.
Oh, you couldn't contain yourself.
No.
Nurse Kramer reported zealously in an injured tone. "Sue Ann, he said something absolutely horrible to me. Oh, I can't even make myself repeat it." "She called me a gear," Ysserion muttered. Nurse Duckett was not sympathetic. "Will you get back into bed," she said, "or must I take you by your ear and put you there?" "Take me by my ear and put me there," Ysserion dared her. Nurse Duckett took him by his ear and put him back in bed.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, dear, dear.
So, Arfi did the same thing again on a flight.
Arfi's a danger to everyone. I think we're going to get another Arfi chapter.
Well, here's the weird thing. Ysserion being actually injured, I think we're at the furthest in the timeline we've been yet.
Probably, yeah. I think so.
Because you'd think we would have heard about him being shot in the thigh before now.
I'm still trying to get my head wrapped around the beginning. It's saying that Nately fell in love with the girl.
Mm-hmm.
Because... Okay, so Ysserion moved the bomb line in the Siege of Bologna, which meant Major de Coverley got disappeared. And then Enlistedman's apartment...
Oh, yeah, we don't really know what... Arfi was blaming Ysserion for at the start of the chapter.
He wasn't. It was not Arfi. It's the author saying, if it's Ysserion's fault, had there not been that movement, then de Coverley wouldn't have been... de Coverley would have been still around. And the Enlistedman's... And had the Enlistedman's apartment not been filled with girls, Nately might not have fallen in love with his girl. Weird, but it's weird, and I think it's because it's the idea of I think Major de Coverley did make sure that the enlisted men and the enlisted versus
officers
that they were separate, and I think that's different here, and with the girls and whatnot, I think there's something going on in terms of the structure, saying like this whole scenario where Nately falls in love is actually partially because of the fact that Bologna caused a knock-on effect.
Hmm.
And then you have the situation where Arfi keeps accidentally... Arfi has no sense of direction and somehow is a navigator.
Yeah.
That's and zero understanding or zero interest in actually doing something as long as someone is not like the fact that he's a good riddance to trash and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
this is a person who thinks a lot about himself and a lot about his importance and a lot about his career and who he needs to be as opposed to anything else.
Well, to me, the funniest line in the whole chapter was how he knew about true love because he'd fallen in love with Knightley's father, and the idea of working for him after the war is a...
Yeah, he's a little ambitious social climber. He's a climber. Which is what
Cathcart.
When Knightley was reflecting that his father had warned him about climbers and pushers.
Mm. I get you, yeah.
Yeah, and what's his name? What's his cool name? Milo is a pusher.
Mm.
And
Arfie's
a climber, I think, I can't remember what that was. I'll have to look it up because that's going to be stuck in my head now.
I'm pretty sure that was it.
Okay, Arfie's a climber, Milo's a pusher. Yeah, that kind of attitude is, and the fact that he's got enough gumption to recognize that. But obviously not enough gumption to not fall for someone who may not reciprocate.
Yeah, because it did seem at this point, even though he had money, she didn't want anything to do with him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's weird. Which means she's not doing, like, she's not just thinking about herself.
Well, it did mention, like, she seemed fairly fatigued in almost every scene she was in.
And we have discussed the fact that it might be that she's sick.
Mm.
She might be dying of some sort of illness, which is very likely, or has seen a lot of death given it's a war.
Yeah. So, yeah, then we have the horrible thing with Yusarian getting shot, which still had some humor in it because Yusarian thought he lost his testicles.
Yes. I mean, it was funny in the sense that the way he responded, but at the same time, that's how he was coping with the horror.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating that Arfie, again, is putting people's lives in danger.
Yeah. And then...
he does it again and again, but yeah.
And then Yusarian Dunbar, what a duo to be in a hospital with.
Such a bad combo. It's like, yeah, from a health perspective, I'm like going, why would you switch beds with someone else? You don't know what they're getting treated for. Well, that would explain the whole, it's not fair, you've got this and I've got that, and I should have your thing and you should have my thing kind of thing.
Actually, that may be exactly what that is.
Yeah. It's like, are they actually with these things, or is it that they on paper have been missed because it's all been jumbled up?
Yeah, we just got another piece of the puzzle. That could be a very plausible explanation for...
That could explain a lot.
Yeah.
And Nurse Kramer's just foolish. Like, mate, don't you know? You should lie down. Blocks the way. Okay, move.
And your leg belongs to the U.S. government.
Get stuffed. Move.
Well, it is pretty early on in the episode. Would you like to attempt another chapter?
Let us try. I don't know how long this chapter is. Can you double check?
Yeah, have a look at that first. But it looks to be similar size to the one we just read.
Okay, so let's go for it.
Maybe a little longer. Chapter 27, Nurse Duckett. Nurse Sue Ann Duckett was a tall, spare, mature, straight-backed woman with a prominent, well-rounded ass, small breasts, and angular, ascetic New England features that came equally close to being very lovely and very plain. Her skin was white and pink, her eyes small, her nose and chin slender and sharp. She was able, prompt, strict, and intelligent. She welcomed responsibility and kept her head in every crisis. She was adult and self-reliant, and there was nothing else she needed from anyone. Yusarian took pity and decided to help her. Next morning, while she was standing bent over smoothing the sheets at the foot of his bed, he slipped his hand stealthily into the narrow space between her knees and all at once brought it up swiftly under her dress as far as it would go. Nurse Duckett shrieked and jumped into the air a mile, but it wasn't high enough, and she squirmed and vaulted and seesawed back and forth on her defined fulcrum for almost the full 15 seconds before she wiggled free finally and retreated frantically into the aisle with an ashen, trembling face. She backed away too far, and Dunbar, who had watched from the beginning, sprang forward on his bed without warning and flung both arms around her bosom from behind. Nurse Duckett let out another scream and twisted away, fleeing far enough from Dunbar for Yessarian to lunge forward and grab her by the snatch again. Yeah. Nurse Duckett bounced out across the aisle once more like a ping-pong ball with legs. Dunbar was waiting vigilantly, ready to pounce. She remembered him just in time and leaped aside. Dunbar missed completely and sailed by her over the bed to the floor, landing on his skull with a soggy crunching thud that knocked him cold. He woke up on the floor with a bleeding nose and exactly the same distressful head symptoms he had been feigning all along. The ward was in a chaotic uproar. Nurse Duckett was in tears, and the Assyrian was consoling her apologetically as he sat beside her on the edge of a bed. The commanding colonel was wroth and shouting at Yessarian that he would not permit his patients to take indecent liberties with his nurses. "What do you want from him?" Dunbar asked plaintively from the floor, wincing at the vibrating pains in his temples that his voice set up. "He didn't do anything. I'm talking about you," the then-dignified colonel bellowed as loudly as he could. "You're going to be punished for what you did." "What do you want from him?" Yessarian called out. "All he did was fall on his head, and I'm talking about you too," the colonel declared, whirling to rage at Yessarian. "You're going to be good and sorry you grabbed Nurse Duckett by the bosom." "I didn't grab Nurse Duckett by the bosom," said Yessarian. "I grabbed her by the bosom," said Dunbar. "Are you both crazy?" the doctor cried shrilly, backing away in paling confusion. "Yes, he really is crazy, Doc," Dunbar assured him. "Every night he dreams he's holding a live fish in his hands." The doctor stopped in his tracks with a look of elegant amazement and distaste, and the ward grew still. "He does what?" he demanded. "He dreams of holding a live fish in his hand." "What kind of fish?" the doctor inquired sternly of Yessarian. "I don't know," Yessarian answered. "I can't tell one kind of fish from another." "In which hand do you hold them?" "It varies," answered Yessarian. "It varies with the fish," Dunbar added helpfully. The colonel turned and stared down at Dunbar suspiciously with a narrow squint. "Yes, and how come you seem to know so much about it?" "I'm in the dream," Dunbar answered with that cracking smile. The colonel's face flushed with embarrassment. He glared at them both with cold, unforgiving resentment. "Get up off the floor and into your bed," he directed Dunbar through thin lips, "and I don't want to hear another word about this dream from either one of you. I've got a man on my staff to listen to disgusting bilge like this." "Just why do you think," carefully inquired Major Sanderson, the soft and vixen smiling staff psychiatrist to whom the colonel had ordered the Yessarian sent, "that Colonel Farage finds your dream disgusting?" Yessarian replied respectfully, "I suppose it's either some quality in the dream or some quality in Colonel Farage." "That's very well put," applauded Major Sanderson, who wore squeaking GI shoes and had charcoal black hair that stood up almost straight. "For some reason," he confided, "Colonel Farage has always reminded me of a seagull. He doesn't put much faith in psychiatry, you know." "You don't like seagulls, do you?" inquired Yessarian. "No, not very much," admitted Major Sanderson with a sharp, nervous laugh and pulled at his pendulous second chin lovingly, as though it were a long... as though it were a long goatee. So the image in my head of that is...
Yeah...
"I think your dream is charming, and I hope it recurs frequently so that we can continue discussing it. Would you like a cigarette?" He smiled when Yessarian declined. "Just why do you think," he asked knowingly, "that you have such a strong aversion to accepting a cigarette from me? I put one out a second ago. It's still smoldering in your ashtray." Major Sanderson chuckled. "That's a very ingenious explanation, but I suppose we'll soon discover the true reason." He tied a sloppy double bow in his open shoelace and then transferred a lined yellow pad from his desk to his lap. "This fish you dream about, let's talk about that. It's always the same fish, isn't it?" "I don't know," Yessarian replied. "I have trouble recognizing fish." "What does the fish remind you of?" "Other fish." "And what do other fish remind you of?" "Other fish." Major Sanderson sat back disappointedly. "Do you like fish?" "Not especially." "Just why do you think you have such a morbid aversion to fish?" asked Major Sanderson triumphantly. "They're too bland," Yessarian answered, "and too bony." Major Sanderson nodded understandably with a smile that was agreeable and insincere. That's a very interesting explanation, but we'll soon discover the true reason, I suppose. Do you like this particular fish? The one you're holding in your hand? I have no feelings about it either way. Do you dislike the fish? Do you have any hostile or aggressive emotions toward it? No, not at all. In fact, I rather like the fish. Then you do like the fish. Oh no, I have no feelings toward it either way. But you just said you liked it. Now you say you have no feelings toward it either way. I've just caught you in a contradiction, don't you see? Yes, sir, I suppose you have caught me in a contradiction. Major Sanderson proudly lettered contradiction on his pad with his thick black pencil. Just why do you think, he resumed when he had finished looking up, that you made those two statements expressing contradictory emotional responses to the fish? I suppose I have an ambivalent attitude toward it. Major Sanderson sprang up with joy when he heard the words ambivalent attitude. You do understand, he exclaimed, wringing his hands together ecstatically. Oh, you can't imagine how lonely it's been for me, talking day after day to patients who haven't the slightest knowledge of psychiatry, trying to cure people who have no real interest in me or my work. It's given me such a terrible feeling of inadequacy. A shadow of anxiety crossed his face. I can't seem to shake it. Really? Asked the Assyrian, wondering what else to say. Why do you blame yourself for gaps in the education of others? It's silly, I know, Major Sanderson replied uneasily with a giddy, involuntary laugh. But I've always depended very heavily on the good opinion of others. I reached puberty a bit later than all the other boys my age, you see, and it's given me sort of, well, all sorts of problems. I just know I'm going to enjoy discussing them with you. I'm so eager to begin that I'm almost reluctant to digress now to your problem, but I'm afraid I must.
Yeah, he's not. Yeah, wow. That's ethically an interesting situation.
You know, so far in this book, I think we're a far like a sea away from ethics.
Yeah.
In all manner. Colonel Farage would be cross if he knew we were spending all our time on me. I'd like to show you some ink blots now to find out what certain shapes and colors remind you of. You can save yourself the trouble, Doctor. Everything reminds me of sex. Does it? Cried Major Sanderson with delight, as though unable to believe his ears. Now we're really getting somewhere. Do you ever have any good sex dreams? My fish dream is a sex dream. No, I mean real sex dreams. The kind where you grab some naked by the neck and pinch her and punch her in the face till she's all bloody and then throw yourself down to ravish her and burst into tears because you love her and hate her so much you don't know what else to do. That's the kind of sex dreams I like to talk about. Don't you ever have sex dreams like that? Yessarian reflected a moment with a wise look. That's a fish dream, he decided. Major Sanderson recoiled as though he had been slapped. Yes, of course, he conceded frigidly, his manner changing to one of edgy and defensive antagonism. But I'd like you to dream one like that anyway, just to see how you react. That will be all for today. In the meantime, I'd also like you to dream up the answers to some of those questions I asked you. These sessions are no more pleasant for me than they are for you, you know. I'll mention it to Dunbar, Yossarian replied. Dunbar? He's the one who started it all. It's his dream. Oh, Dunbar, Major Sanderson sneered, his confidence returning. I'll bet Dunbar is that evil fellow who really does all those nasty things you're always being blamed for, isn't he? He's not so evil, and yet you'll defend him to the very death, won't you? Not that far. Major Sanderson smiled tauntingly and wrote Dunbar on his pad. Why are you limping? He asked sharply as the Assyrian moved to the door. And what the devil is that bandage doing on your leg? Are you mad or something? I was wounded in the leg. That's what I'm in the hospital for. Oh, no, you're not, gloated Major Sanderson maliciously. You're in the hospital for a stone in your
Give me a sec. I think he's gotten confused between that it's Ferrari, whatever his name is. He's gotten confused with the people.
Maybe there's more bed swapping.
No, because of the bed swapping, the person's been, there's been a mix-up.
You're in the hospital for a stone in your salivary gland. So you're not so smart after all, are you? You don't even know what you're in the hospital for. I'm in the hospital for a wounded leg, Yossarian insisted. Major Sanderson ignored his argument with a sarcastic laugh. Well, give my regards to your friend Dunbar, and you will tell him to dream that dream for me, won't you? But Dunbar had nausea and dizziness with his constant headache and was not inclined to cooperate with Major Sanderson. Hungry Joe had nightmares because he had finished 60 missions and was waiting again to go home, but he was unwilling to share any when he came to the hospital to visit. Ah, and there you go. 60 missions. Yeah, we're the furthest along in the timeline so far. Wow. Hasn't anyone got any dreams for Major Sanderson, Yusarian asked. I'd hate to disappoint him. He feels so rejected already. I've been having a very peculiar dream ever since I learned you were wounded, confessed the chaplain. I used to dream every night that my wife was dying or being murdered or that my children were choking to death on morsels of nutritious food. Now I dream that I'm out swimming in water over my head and a shark is eating my left leg in exactly the same place where you have your bandage. That's a wonderful dream, Dunbar declared. I bet Major Sanderson will love it. That's a horrible dream, Major Sanderson cried. It's filled with pain and mutilation and death. I'm sure you had it just to spite me. You know, I'm not even sure you belong in the army with a disgusting dream like that. The Yusarian thought he spied a ray of hope. Perhaps you're right, sir, he suggested slyly. Perhaps I ought to be grounded and returned to the States. Hasn't it ever occurred to you that in your promiscuous pursuit of women, you are merely trying to assuage your subconscious fears of sexual impotence? Yes, sir, it has. Then why do you do it? To assuage my fears of sexual impotence. Why don't you get yourself a good hobby instead? Major Sanderson inquired with friendly interest. Like fishing. Do you really find Nurse Duckett so attractive? I should think she was rather bony. Rather bland and bony, you know. Like a fish. I hardly know Nurse Duckett. Then why did you grab her by the bosom? Merely because she has one? Dunbar did that. Oh, don't start that again, Major Sanderson exclaimed with vitriolic scorn, and hurled down his pencil disgustedly. Do you really think that you can absolve yourself of guilt by pretending to be someone else? I don't like you, Fortiori. Do you know that? I don't like you at all. And there you go, Rue. You were right.
Yeah.
Yusarian felt a cold, damp wind of apprehension blow over him. I'm not Fortiori, sir, he said timidly. I'm Yusarian. You're who? My name is Yusarian, sir, and I'm in the hospital with a wounded leg. Your name is Fortiori, Major Sanderson contradicted him belligerently, and you're in the hospital for a stone in your salivary gland. Oh, come on, Major, Yusarian exploded. I ought to know who I am. And I've got an official army record here to prove it, Major Sanderson retorted. You'd better get a grip on yourself before it's too late. First you're Dunbar, now you're Yusarian. Next thing you know, you'll be claiming you're Washington Irving. Do you know what's wrong with you? You've got a split personality. That's what's wrong with you.
So here's the communication, the constant communication issues. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you're right, sir, Yusarian agreed diplomatically. I know I'm right. You've got a bad persecution complex. You think people are trying to harm you. People are trying to harm me. You see? You have no respect for excessive authority or obsolete traditions. Obsolete traditions. You're dangerous and depraved, and you ought to be taken outside and shot. Are you serious? You're an enemy of the people. Are you nuts? Yusarian shouted. No, I'm not nuts, Dobbs roared furiously back in the ward in what he imagined was a furtive whisper. Hungry Joe saw them, I tell you. He saw them yesterday when he flew to Naples to pick up some black market air conditioners for Colonel Cathcart's farm. They've got a big replacement center there, and it's filled with hundreds of pilots, bombardiers, and gunners on the way home. They've got 45 missions, that's all. A few with Purple Hearts have even less. Replacement crews are pouring in from the States into the other bomber groups. They want everyone to serve overseas at least once, even administrative personnel. Don't you read the papers? We've got to kill them now. You've got only two more missions to fly, Yusarian reasoned with him in a low voice. Why take a chance? I can get killed flying them too, Dobbs answered pugnaciously in his rough, quavering, overwrought voice. We can kill him the first thing tomorrow morning when he drives back from his farm. I've got the gun right here. Yusarian goggled with amazement as Dobbs pulled a gun out of his pocket and displayed it high in the air. Are you crazy? He hissed frantically. Put it away and keep your idiot voice down. What are you worried about? Dobbs asked with offended innocence. No one can hear us. Hey, knock it off down there, a voice rang out from the far end of the ward. Can't you see we're trying to nap? What the hell are you, a wise guy? Dobbs yelled back and spun around with clenched fists ready to fight. He whirled back to Yessarian, and before he could speak, sneezed thunderously 6 times, staggering sideways on rubbery legs in the intervals and raising his elbows ineffectually to fend each seizure off. The lids of his watery eyes were puffy and inflamed. "Who does he think?" he demanded, sniffling spasmodically and wiping his nose with the back of his sturdy wrist. "He is. A cop or something." "He's a CID man," Yessarian notified him tranquilly. "We've got 3 here now and more on the way." "No, don't be scared. They're after a forger named Washington Irving. They're not interested in murderers." "Murderers?" Dobbs was affronted. "Why do you call us murderers? Just because we're going to murder Colonel Cathcart?" "Be quiet, damn you," directed Yessarian. "Can't you whisper?" "I am whispering, I." "You're still shouting." "No, I'm not, I." "Hey, shut up down there, will you?" Patients all over the ward began hollering at Dobbs. "I'll fight you all," Dobbs screamed back at them and stood up on a rickety wooden chair, waving the gun wildly. Yessarian caught his arm and yanked him down. Dobbs began sneezing again. "I have an allergy," he apologized when he had finished, his nostrils running and his eyes streaming with tears. "That's too bad. You'd make a great leader of men without it." "Colonel Cathcart's the murderer," Dobbs complained hoarsely when he had shoved away a soiled, crumpled khaki handkerchief. "Colonel Cathcart's the one who's going to murder us all if we don't do something to stop him." "Maybe he won't raise the missions anymore. Maybe 60 is as high as he'll go." "He always raises the missions. You know that better than I do." Dobbs swallowed and bent his intense face very close to Yessarian's, the muscles in his bronze rock-like jaw bunching up into quivering knots. "Just say it's okay, and I'll do the whole thing tomorrow morning. Do you understand what I'm telling you? I'm whispering now, ain't I?" Yessarian tore his eyes away from the gaze of burning entreaty Dobbs had fastened on him. "Why the goddamn hell don't you just go out and do it?" he protested. "Why don't you stop talking to me about it and do it alone?" "I'm afraid to do it alone. I'm afraid to do anything alone." "Then leave me out of it. I'd have to be crazy to get mixed up in something like this now. I've got a $1 million leg wound here. They're going to send me home." "Are you crazy?" Dobbs exclaimed in disbelief. "All you've got there is a scratch. He'll have you back flying combat missions the day you come out, Purple Heart and all." "Then I really will kill him," Yessarian vowed. "I'll come looking for you and we'll do it together." "Then let's do it tomorrow while we still got the chance," Dobbs pleaded. "The chaplain says he's volunteered the group for Avignon again. I may be killed before you get out. Look how these hands of mine shake. I can't fly a plane. I'm not good enough." Yessarian was afraid to say yes. "I want to wait and see what happens first." "The trouble with you is that you just won't do anything," Dobbs complained in a thick, infuriated voice. "I'm doing everything I possibly can," the chaplain explained softly to Yessarian after Dobbs had departed. "I even went to the medical tent to speak to Dr. Nika about helping you." "Yes, I can see," Yessarian suppressed a smile. "What happened?" "They painted my gums purple," the chaplain replied sheepishly. "They painted his toes purple too," Nately added in outrage. "And then they gave him a laxative. But I went back again this morning to see him, and they painted his gums purple again," said Nately. "But I did get to speak to him," the chaplain argued in a plaintive tone of self-justification. "Dr. Danica seems like such an unhappy man. He suspects that someone is plotting to transfer him to the Pacific Ocean. All this time he's been thinking of coming to me for help. When I told him I needed his help, he wondered if there wasn't a chaplain I couldn't go see." The chaplain waited in patient dejection while Yessarian and Dunbar both broke into laughter. "I used to think it was immoral to be unhappy," he continued, as though keening aloud in solitude. "Now I don't know what to think anymore. I'd like to make the subject of immorality the basis of my sermon this Sunday, but I'm not sure I ought to give any sermon at all with these purple gums." Colonel Korn was very displeased with them. "Chaplain, why don't you come into the hospital with us for a while and take it easy?" Yessarian invited. "You could be very comfortable here." The brash inequity of the proposal tempted and amused the chaplain for a second or two. "No, I don't think so," he decided reluctantly. "I want to arrange for a trip to the mainland to see a mail clerk named Wintergreen. Dr. Danica told me he could help." Wintergreen is probably the most influential man in the whole theater of operations. He's not only a mail clerk, but he has access to the mimeograph machine. But he won't help anybody. That's one of the reasons he'll go far. "I'd like to speak to him anyway. There must be somebody who will help you." "Do it for Dunbar, chaplain," Yessarian corrected with a superior air. "I've got this $1 million leg wound that will take me out of combat. If that doesn't do it, there's a psychiatrist who thinks I'm not good enough to be in the army. I'm the one who isn't good enough to be in the army, Dunbar whined jealously. It was my dream. It's not the dream, Dunbar, Yusarian explained. He likes your dream. It's my personality. He thinks it's split. It's split right down the middle, said Major Sanderson, who had laced his lumpy GI shoes for the occasion and had slicked his charcoal doll hair down with some stiffening and redolent tonic. He smiled ostentatiously to show himself reasonable and nice. I'm not saying that to be cruel and insulting, he continued with cruel and insulting delight. I'm not saying it because I hate you and want revenge. I'm not saying it because you rejected me and hurt my feelings terribly. No, I'm a man of medicine, and I'm being coldly objective. I have very bad news for you. Are you man enough to take it? God, no, screamed Yusarian. I'll go right to pieces. Major Sanderson flew instantly into a rage. Can't you even do one thing right, he pleaded, turning beet red with vexation and crashing the sides of both fists down upon his desk together. The trouble with you is you think you're too good for all the conventions of society. You probably think you're too good for me, too, just because I arrived at puberty late. Well, do you know what you are? You're a frustrated, unhappy, disillusioned, undisciplined, maladjusted young man. Major Sanderson's disposition seemed to mellow as he reeled off the uncomplimentary adjectives. Yes, sir, a Yusarian agreed carefully. I guess you're right. Of course I'm right. You're immature. You've been unable to adjust to the idea of war. Yes, sir. You have a morbid aversion to dying. You probably resent the fact that you're at war and might get your head blown off any second. I more than resent it, sir. I'm absolutely incensed. You have deep-seated survival anxieties, and you don't like bigots, bully snobs, or hypocrites. Subconsciously, there are many people you hate. Consciously, sir, consciously, Yusarian corrected in an effort to help. I hate them consciously. You're antagonistic to the idea of being robbed, exploited, degraded, humiliated, or deceived. Misery depresses you. Ignorance depresses you. Persecution depresses you. Violence depresses you. Slums depress you. Greed depresses you. Crime depresses you. Corruption depresses you. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if you're a manic depressive. Yes, sir, perhaps I am. Don't try to deny it. I'm not denying it, sir, said Yusarian, pleased with the miraculous rapport that finally existed between them. I agree with all you've said. Then you admit you're crazy, do you? Crazy? Yusarian was shocked. What are you talking about? Why am I crazy? You're the one who's crazy. Major Sanderson turned red with indignation again and crashed both fists down upon his thighs. Calling me crazy, he shouted in a sputtering rage, is a typically sadistic and vindictive paranoid reaction. You really are crazy. Then why don't you send me home? And I'm going to send you home. They're going to send me home? Yusarian announced jubilantly as he hobbled back into the ward. Me too, a fortiori rejoiced. They just came to my ward and told me. What about me? Dunbar demanded petulantly of the doctors. You, they replied with asperity. You're going with Yusarian, right back into combat. And back into combat they both went. Yusarian was enraged when the ambulance returned him to the squadron, and he went limping for justice to Dr. Nika, who glared at him glumly with misery and disdain. You, Dr. Nika exclaimed mournfully with accusing disgust, the egg-shaped pouches under both eyes firm and censorious. All you ever think of is yourself. Go take a look at the bomb line if you want to see what's been happening since you went to hospital. Yusarian was startled. Are we losing? Losing, Dr. Nika cried. The whole military situation has been going to hell ever since we captured Paris. I knew it would happen. He paused, his sulking ire turning to melancholy, and frowned irritably as though it were all Yusarian's fault. American troops are pushing into German soil. The Russians have captured back all of Romania. Only yesterday, the Greeks in the 8th Army captured Rimini. The Germans are on the defensive everywhere. Dr. Nika paused again and fortified himself with a huge breath for a piercing ejaculation of grief. There's no more Luftwaffe left, he wailed. He seemed ready to burst into tears. The whole Gothic line is in danger of collapsing. So? Asked Yusarian. What's wrong? What's wrong? Dr. Nika cried. If something doesn't happen soon, Germany may surrender, and then we'll all be sent to the Pacific. Yusarian gawked at Dr. Nika in grotesque dismay. Are you crazy? Do you know what you're saying? Yeah, it's easy for you to laugh, Dr. Nika sneered. Who the hell is laughing? At least you've got a chance. You're in combat and might get killed, but what about me? I've got nothing to hope for. "You're out of your goddamn head," Yusarian shouted at him emphatically, seizing him by the shirt front. "Do you know that? Now keep your stupid mouth shut and listen to me." Doc Danica wrenched himself away. "Don't you dare talk to me like that. I'm a licensed physician." "Then keep your stupid licensed physician's mouth shut and listen to what they told me up at the hospital. I'm crazy. Did you know that? So? Really crazy. So? I'm nuts. Cuckoo. Don't you understand? I'm off my rocker. They sent someone else home in my place by mistake. They got a licensed psychiatrist up at the hospital who examined me, and that was his verdict. I'm really insane." "So? So?" Yusarian was puzzled by Dr. Nika's inability to comprehend. "Don't you see what that means? Now you can take me off combat duty and send me home. They're not going to send a crazy man out to be killed, are they? Who else will go?" Ah, Yusarian was so close to being able to go home.
Yep.
Of course, we're nowhere near the end of the book, so of course it couldn't have been that easy.
Yeah, no, that was painful. Poor guy. Yeah, far out. Who does this, man?
So what are your thoughts on the psychiatrist, Major Sanderson?
He is also, he's not well. This is going to require a whole bunch of warnings at the beginning of the content notes.
So yeah, well, the whole start of the chapter was pretty much, well, it was sexual assault by Yusarian Dunbar.
Yep.
Pretty terrible.
Yep. There was, and then the very violent and graphic dream of the psychiatrist.
Yeah.
Who I think is themselves someone who probably needs to be admitted.
Well, remember how happy he was once Yusarian started kind of acting as psychiatrist for him.
Yeah. They're not well. And then the hospital's just chaos. And I mean, there was a comment that as the longer they were there, the worse the care is getting.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
But the worst thing is that Yusarian's not healed. His leg's still bad and they just sent him back out there.
Yeah. Just...
Dobbs went to see him in the hospital because, Cathcart has volunteered his men for Avignon again. So he wants to kill him right now, but Yusarian still doesn't want to.
But before that as well, he said that he went somewhere else and all the other...
Yep.
Like, they do their 45 missions and off they go.
Yep. Especially because the U.S. wants everyone to serve before the war is over.
Yeah, so the whole thing is not cool.
Yep.
I honestly think that I understand why Dobbs would want to.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, premeditated murder of another man is awful, but I can understand why.
Yeah, it's just the whole situation's chaotic, miscommunications and direct harm. Like, the whole thing is nasty.
Yeah, there was a lot of miscommunication. And funny enough, I think because of it, I didn't find it as funny as the previous chapter.
Well, it's frustrating because he was so close to getting home.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why it's discouraging. And, I mean, arguably, it was Dunbar's fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the hospital records also shouldn't have been jumbled up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit discouraging. Poor guy. I don't know. The way that they treated the nurse was also just... They were needing a psychiatrist. I mean, the fact that the... I think Cathcart has wrecked these people completely. I mean, war does wreck people, but Cathcart pushing them way beyond where they should be.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a mess. It's a mess. I feel very bad for them. I was going to close it. The fact that Dobbs can't tell how loud he's speaking.
Yeah. Basically planning Cathcart's murder right in the middle of everyone listening. including an increasing number of CID men.
Who are trying to find Washington Irving. It's so funny. I'm trying to figure out whether this is before or after Milo bombs the...
Oh. Yeah, I don't know when that bombing happened.
I don't know which sequence it is. It's a bit tricky to place the timeline.
Because the Milo bombing their own place, there was no link to like the missions, so we didn't really know where in the timeline that was.
I can't remember what it was in relation to the missions, or if it, no, there was no mention of it really. Very confusing.
Yeah. Very confusing. But also, especially in that last chapter, as we're moving towards the climax of the book, you can kind of feel, yeah, there's more tension. Things are more desperate. Ysarion really needs to get out of there.
Yes, very much so. Because it's become a bit ridiculous at this point. But he is. Oh, dear. Poor guys. And just the way they're treating the nurses, the way that they're behaving, their attitude, the way Arfi, my gosh, Arfi. I need Arfi not to survive. That is simply where we're at now when it comes to Arfi.
Well, I guess we'll see if you get your wish.
At this point, I'm like, just no, you're not allowed to survive, Arfi. You're not allowed.
Well, you know, you usually the ones that don't deserve it get. You know what I'm saying. I'm saying that the people that deserve things usually don't get it, and those that don't deserve it.
Yeah.
I'm confusing myself now, but I think you all understand what I mean. I was just looking at what the next chapter was, and it's called Dobbs, so maybe this will be more about his assassination attempt.
His plot. His nefarious scheme. Hopefully. We'll see. Maybe he'll do it. Maybe he won't. Schrödinger's scheme. Schrödinger's Dobbs.
So if Cathcart were to be killed, it would be Korn who would have to step up to his position, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but Korn wouldn't do some of the silliness that Cathcart's been doing because he knows better. He's setting up Cathcart to fail.
Mm.
So there is that. And if he's setting up Cathcart to fail, that's why he's letting him treat the soldiers like the squadron like crap.
Mm.
Which makes sense. Yes.
Well, that was those were two pretty intense chapters.
Very much so.
But I hope you all enjoyed that. Hopefully our next episode will both be a little livelier, although I think this was more of a reaction episode than a discussion episode, just because what's happened is so heavy. So maybe next time we will have had the time to process.
It's a difficult topic as well, because we're talking about the like medical malpractice and a bunch of other stuff, and they're always interesting.
And we're watching desperate men become more desperate.
Yeah, pretty much. It's pretty bad. The whole situation is
so much so that I don't know. Does it feel like this book is going to have a good ending?
No, it's war. I don't see this is going well. The fact that Dr. Nika mentioned the Pacific makes me realize that the chances that he's going to get sent to the Pacific is high.
Mm-hmm. And that was an interesting little discussion about how, you know, the Allies are winning the war, the Germany's on the defensive on every front, and the Assyrian's like, but that's great news. And he's like, no, it's terrible, because then we won't go home. I'll get sent to the Pacific Theater.
Yeah, because he's a doctor. Yes, yeah. That's the downside of being a doctor, is that even you don't have to, you don't serve in terms of combat. But the thing is that based on my limited understanding from MASH, which of course is not a reliable source of information, but there was the idea that if you spent a certain amount of time there, that would do it. Like that would be it. And then you get sent out. But because he's not actually treating anyone.
Yeah.
So he's not getting covered. He's not getting the point, quote unquote, points that you need so that you can.
But hey, if you want your gums painted purple and be fed laxatives, he's your man.
Exactly. Oof. Well, not even him. His
Gus and Wes.
Exactly. So it's not really him. So it's he's not actually doing his job, well, except for when Milo did the bombing.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm trying to figure out trying to figure out where this is in relation to that. Like, where is Dr. Nika at?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
Because if this is post-Milo, then that makes sense that he's just given up and he's frustrated and he's freaked out. But if this is pre-Milo, that works as well. Like, his selflessness, like him actually doing something, is, doesn't exist yet.
Yeah, something so outrageous as what Milo did finally made him start to give a crap again.
About other people, yeah. I don't know. There's some, I don't know whether something has happened between Milo's attack and him, that kind of stuff. Like, I want to know, but I have to wait until next time. Yeah. On So Many Books, So Little Time.
So, folks, yeah, thank you for joining us. The music at the top of the podcast is Soap Runs by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. It is from the 2019 adaptation of Catch-22. The music at the end is always is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at Rue McMoo. That's on Twitter. And you can find our podcast as SMBSLT Podcast. That's on Facebook, that is Twitter, and that is also with an @gmail.com, our email address that you can send an email to.
And if you listen to us on any platform that allows you to rate or review, we would greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. Yes.
So, until next time, stay safe, enjoy your reading, and we'll see you all next week.
Waving at the microphone is not helpful. Goodbye!